Hello, everybody that is not listening. It is I, the omnipotent, the omnivorous, the omnifarious.
Shut the fuck up, Omni.
My bad, let's get on the show then. For better or worse, until the worst gets better. I'ma let you release to an eased up pressure. A solo member, God, still with no contenders. Who don't remember the future, but predicts the past. Makes hits off wax, gets rich off trash. Gets shits on cash and takes hits off stash. I give the one-man crowd a very loud silence. A heroic violence, so only the broken biting. A logical artist with the stupid smartness. I live to love, and I love to be heartless. Standing still, but my words keep on marching. I keep it moving, so I can stop starting. Driving on parkways, but on driveways I'm parking. Softly hardened, cause this is hardly easy. Picking up tapes and dropping cheap CDs. The price you pay for these expensive freebies. I'm a hypocrite that's meant to spit. I tell the truth, no evidence. I'm heaven sent, contradiction in all of my messages. Bring both sides of the story into one excellence. Omni, call me the positive pessimist. I'm leading the followers by following the leader. I'm eating these swallowers that bite like the teeth. I'm teaching students to be the student teacher by listening to the mic and rapping through the speakers. A preacher to the shepherd of atheistic believers. I rehearse each verse and listen when I speak words. Do both at once, cause everything's the same. Rearrange with different names, yo, the yin and the yang. My underground's in the main, cause it's bot like. I'm on top like, but not in the spotlight. I rock like I'm giving you a burning frostbite. A humble ego that's hella dope, but it's not tight. I get you confused like two dogs in a cat fight. Mad nice, black, white, mixed into gray. I brought the extra medium on yesterday's tomorrow. Happy sorrow, so have yourself a good bad day. I'm a hypocrite that's meant to spit. I tell the truth, no evidence. I'm heaven sent, contradiction in all of my messages. Bring both sides of the story into one excellence. Omni, call me the positive pessimist. I'm a veteran rookie that's better than nothing. Doomed to be lucky and tells the truth by bluffing. A pretty ugly, one-sided discussion. A perfect human disguised as a Democratic Republican. Bringing chaotic order to this equally free government. Pay taxes, be yet for money spent before I have a touch of it. I hate loving it, but I love to hate it. My calm adrenaline rush leaves me soberly sedated. The thought of freedom is the one unspoken statement. The real fakeness that keeps the world the same changes. The same faces remain faceless, same cages remain slaveless. Reading pages filled up with the same blankness. A light heavyweight spitting his written freestyle. Who am I kidding? I won't admit it, but I'm in denial. Deeply shallow, normally crazy, never be maybe. Every day he's patiently waiting like he's aggressively lazy. I'm a hypocrite that's meant to spit. I tell the truth, no evidence. I'm heaven sent, contradiction in all of my messages. Bring both sides of the story into one excellence. Omni, call me the positive pessimist.
Whoa, man, no predictions by my good friend Omni. Hey, this is Andrew Fetter, and I'm welcome y'all to When Pigs Fly. Because, like I said, there ain't no donkeys or elephants out here. Well, it's another real hot day out here in Las Vegas. It's about 109 hitting up there. It's been a really good week, though. I'm hoping everybody's having a great week. And first of all, I want to thank you all listening and all the future listeners and for listening to my show. I got a couple one particular announcement. Tomorrow, on June 21st, I will be doing a special book signing event at the Borders Bookstore in Town Square, 6521 South Las Vegas Boulevard. And that will be from 1 to 3 o'clock. Officially the first author doing that signing event. It's a rather large store. It's a three-level bookstore. So if you come by Vegas, and you have to be in Vegas tomorrow, come by down, chat, whatever. And love to see you and hear what you guys all think. Also, speaking of which, if you check out my past shows, if you have any comments, questions, whatever, even if it's from talking about Kabbalah, out-of-body, regressions, or free energy, even if you have questions about John Searle, Tesla, please do give me a caller, and you can contact me at flyingpigs at artlover.com, or of course, if you got MySpace account, that's Andrew Fetter / you know. And now I have a very, very special guest, which His name is Stephen Mitchell. He has a very interesting, in fact, intriguing film called Dragons and Rings. I know when you first hear the name, you think of like a video game, but it deals with a lot of our sciences and quantum sciences. But let me give you a brief background of Stephen Mitchell, because I think that's also really impaired understanding where he's coming from. And he's a very multi-dimensional person. He's definitely a Renaissance man. And he has honored degrees in both mathematics and music, which you can see in his ambience. He carries with him both his cognitive work and as well his artistical abilities. And he has graduated, since graduating, he has worked as a musician with Warner Chappell, Warner Brothers Reality Entertainment, Australian TV, and he's a member of the PRS. And he has done several lectures and giving workshops and also served and facilitated for events from management training to alternative energies, including quantum physics, NLP, the British Society of Dower Special Research, as well as, of course, making numerous films for various groups. So he's definitely a seasoned filmmaker. And on top of that, he is a trained counselor in Reiki. He's a Reiki master and also a chalice master, and uses his combination of positive life affirmations, shiatsu, NLP, as basic techniques to enable and affect constructive, valuable path changes to one's own path, which is also interesting because he also incorporates his knowledge of quantum and scalar electromagnetic sciences in his methods in therapy, which is real, fascinating. Way above our time right now. Welcome, Steve. Are you still there?
I'm still here. Hi.
Yeah, that's a fascinating long bio. Definitely from different perspectives and putting it all in one package.
I kind of listen to that and think, who's the guy you're speaking about? Is that me? It doesn't sound like me.
Yeah, that's not me. That's some other guy, right?
Yeah, that's some really clever guy. Yes, yeah. All very interesting. Go on.
Well, my curiosity when I first saw the name of your movie called Dragons and Rings, the first thing that pops in is almost like, it's one of those video games, or it's an arcade game, or it's a like a medieval type of thing. And yet it deals, when you watch it, it's dealing with, I would call it science mind or science consciousness. It's dealing with the elixir between metaphysics as well as quantum physics. And go beyond that, because we get into Maxwell's physics as well. So why did you name this film, before you go in the background of the movie, why did you name it Dragon and Rings?
Well, there's actually two reasons. I kind of like the lyrics of Black Sabbath, and I kind of like the lyrics of a particular song, and one of them was kind of Dragons and Rings. So that kind of jumped out at me. But the main reason is really because it's about the place where quantum, if you like, science meets the esoteric, and specifically the kind of angles that I'm interested in terms of stone circles, ley lines, and all that sort of stuff. And ley lines are known as dragon lines, and supposedly channel so-called dragon energy. So that's the dragon side of things. And rings, obviously, with respect to stone circles. So it kind of conjures up that kind of image. Like you say, there's that kind of whole video game kind of thing to it. And I think the thing that I try to do within the film is make it as accessible, as interactive as possible. There's no kind of stop points where you ask questions and stuff. But certainly the film in itself, I kind of left as much unsaid as said, so people could watch it and kind of take what they wanted out of it and do something with it rather than just go, oh yeah, that's good, put it on the shelf and go away.
Yeah, because what I felt with the book is the movie is more like a, first of all, when you watch it, it goes on the assumption that people might be pretty novice, which about sciences, so people won't be afraid of, oh my, when they hear quantum physics, they just right away shut down, or they hear something physics or mathematics, they go, oh my God, this is beyond me. And it allows a person to watch it and, like, piecemeal things together. And it, what it has a lot of information in there. And I, when you watch it, it's not just, and you watch it the first time, then you go, wait a second, let me watch that part too. And, of course, it's sectioned in a DVD, so you can actually go by scenes to go and check out what things that you want to rehash or look at. First of all, how long did it take you to create this movie?
The process itself isn't too long. It's the information that's in there, really. It's accumulative pieces of information that I've kind of built up since the year dot, really. I started out interested in all this kind of stuff in my very early teens and lived near somewhere called the Ridgeway, which is a huge kind of tract of land that kind of includes stone circles and cairns and mounds. So I've got all this stuff floating around, and I've done workshops, as you said, for years on all these kind of subjects, and I wanted to bring it together. So I guess, in a way, it wasn't so hard as kind of putting together a huge kind of film. I already had it there. I'd already got notes from workshops, concepts from workshops, and talks and things that I'd given. So the script probably took me a few weeks to kind of piece together and just kind of check on some of the background stuff and then get it into, like you say, that kind of accessible state where someone can watch it and understand it without having to kind of go into the in-depth science aspect of it. The images themselves, I guess I spent a little while, a month or so, kind of on a field trip, wandering around filming crop circles, filming stone circles, and then kind of combining various graphics on the top end of that. And then the music, some of it's my own music in there, some of it's other bands, so I had to create a music track to it. So I guess it's probably, in terms of production length and sort of sitting down writing the script to getting a final product, about 2 to 3 months.
Oh, wow. So it's pretty, because I've worked in the film industry, so that's why I was curious. So I know it's like an intense thing when you do it. Your life is your film, pretty much. You don't have no friends or relatives or anybody while you're on the project. It's like, and people don't realize how much when you see film and somebody's put film, especially when you're doing it like what you've done, especially it's coming from yourself. You know, it's very intriguing, because you're just, it's like an artist putting something on a moving canvas.
Yeah.
So
I think I'm lucky nowadays. I mean, when I first worked in film, they worked on tape. Everything was pneumatic tape, so you had kind of streams of tape running all over the place, and if you were lucky, you got a 2 or 3 tape machine, so you could kind of do crossfade editing and so forth. And that process took you ages just to produce 5 or 10 minutes worth of stuff. Nowadays, I can sit on a computer, download all my imagery into the computer, and like you say, you know, you don't have many friends around, but you get up at 9 o'clock in the morning and you might go to bed at 1 or 2 in the morning, having spent the day sitting on the computer putting everything together. But it does make the process as well far easier to produce that bit of something that you can produce that is relevant to you, and that you can edit it in the way that you want to. With the technology available nowadays, it's, you know, it's an excellent way to be able to work.
So for the audience out there, so they have like maybe a synopsis or a view of what Dragons and Rings is all about, what would you, so they have a basic, and you know, because I mentioned quantum physics and metaphysics. What, in your words, what would you think to explain what your movie is about?
I think it's probably as easy to explain where I come from and the way I think as a person, which is kind of encapsulated in that movie. And essentially, I'm very much kind of drawn to the esoteric, drawn to that side of things, and like I say, have been for many, many years. And what always kind of mattered to me was where science met that point, why science didn't kind of fit. I'd kind of sit there and, in, for example, you know, physics classes in the teens and think, well, I kind of know this stuff happens. I kind of see it, if you like. There's something that's going on in this world. There's something kind of special. And yet science won't have anything to do with it. Why won't anyone kind of take it seriously? And really what I wanted to do was kind of find a point, and which I did, was where actually science does acknowledge that there are strange energies, if you like, in the world. Science does acknowledge that reality is a lot more than we can see, and acknowledges a lot of the stuff that we talk about when we're talking about the esoteric and the kind of formation of the universe as an energetic being. And that was really what I wanted to get over in the DVD, that all along, from way back in, from sort of Pythagoras' time, from Egyptian times, all the way into modern science, through kind of 19th century science, we can find examples of why actually this stuff happens. And to me, it's really important, because from a kind of, if you like, a therapeutical point of view, if you understand the why, if you understand what's going on, it gives you a tool that you can work with it that is beyond that kind of basis of belief or faith. It's something that you can actually apply and say, look, this happens because. And once you can say this happens because, it gives you that edge to be able to work on any level, to, you know, in the NLP or psychological kind of sense, to be able to say, well, this is what's going on in our head. This is what's going on in the world of matter and energy. This is where they meet. So therefore, you know, if you're looking at problem solving, if you're looking at something that's actually very personal to your life, you can see why maybe some of the kind of New Age mantras, some of the New Age techniques are, if you like, a little bit suspect, because they're based on things that aren't necessarily as real. Whereas if you can put that kind of reality into it, that kind of specific, that you can say, look, this is how it actually works, this is how it manipulates, then Bob's your uncle. So, you know, that's kind of where the DVD takes you in a weird way. It takes you from the fact that we have this kind of concept of ley lines, we have this concept of stone circles that do something, but what do? Why were they put there? And then we have science, and science now is answering those questions, and very much, you know, there are a lot of scientists in the field out there who are very high-level scientists, and very much kind of working on these day-to-day things.
Like what you're talking about, I've heard actually and read several things that have actually moved into a more understanding of the quasi, more of an infinite way of looking at things. Like not long ago there was a study, there's actually a lie detector scientist. He took a piece of tissue out of somebody's mouth and he put it and secluded it, and they had it on a monitor on a lie detector while the person who they took it, the host, you want to call it, they monitored his behavior, and he would be like 300 miles away, 400 miles away, and they showed the tissue reacting to the person. And they showed that.
It's absolutely amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's showing how we're all so connected. See, I've always, and I put it out in a lot of my shows, is, you know, to me, people look, the reality is things are not finite, they're infinite, that what we perceive is finite, but that's not the reality of the case. And then even when we try to put things in dimensional terms, it's because so we can simplify it into our minds to understand
Absolutely.
It. But in reality, it's really not, it's actually simple that it's a concept of infinity. And Einstein had said, when we break out of our little bubble is when we change our methods from a finite methodology in sciences to an infinite approach into sciences. That's why he has the curve in space.
Absolutely.
It's not really a curve, it's like a bend.
Yeah.
So you can, it's a logarithm where you guess where it approximately might be. So it's really an infinite way of looking at it.
Totally, absolutely. The curve that you're talking about, I think, if you apply the bell curve into it, that kind of sums up our experience pretty much. Our experience is kind of varied to a certain level, but it's limited by a kind of bell curve, where the top peak of the bell curve is that we kind of are very familiar with and experience, and the kind of edges are that we're slightly unfamiliar with. But the outside of the bell curve is everything else. It's all that infinite kind of absolute everything that exists. And I guess a lot of what, you know, what I do and what a lot of people are working on really in terms of the psychological aspects of it NLP aspects of it, the kind of working aspect, is to open up that bell curve and allow people to say, well, our experience is literally limited by what we're prepared to accept, what we're comfortable with. And if we, you know, expand that comfort blanket a little bit, we can take on a lot more and be a lot more and be who we really want to be, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and for my audience out there, what's the PNLP stand for?
NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming.
Okay.
Essentially, what that looks at is how we model our universe, mostly through language skills, the way that we limit ourselves in the way that we speak about things. We use language that's very limiting all the time.
So it's our identification of our perspective of things, basically. It's our perception of things.
Yeah, absolutely. A really, really super-duper easy example is, how many times do we say we're going to try and do something? 1 billion times. Someone will say, oh, can you do that? You say, oh, I'll give it a go. I'll try. And the simple fact is that trying itself, as an example, is an action. The more you try and do something, you're actually putting effort into trying rather than achieving. And if you change your language that simply to saying, well, I'm going to do it, then more often than not, you actually do it simply because you're focusing on the doing, not the act of trying to do it. And the trying becomes a kind of comfort blanket that allows us to say, well, if it doesn't succeed, it doesn't matter, you know, and allows us to actually limit ourselves. So that's a really easy example of how, if you like, we formulate a whole reality and kind of put this kind of blanket around ourselves by the language that we use, by the way that we approach people, approach events, approach things around us in a very limiting fashion.
So, like, it's like in the perspective, because I lived over in the Middle East, and people who speak, if you learn a language of another culture, you'll understand why they all have a certain different perspective of things just out of their own language. But I find that it's also the way you people look at things. It's like the Native American Indians. They didn't have an idea of what, they didn't even have word ownership, so they didn't even understand how can you possibly own something, like own land.
So
they had no concept of it, because it's not even in their vocabulary. So it depends on where you're at. Each culture has, like you said, a perspective on their language and what they say. But you know what is fascinating about your show? It's like, it reminded me of a saying that Buddha had said. And that all that we are is the result of what we have thought. The mind is everything. What we think is what we become. And that's
absolutely.
And that's like I try to emphasize in a lot of my shows is thoughts are things, and that in a thought, even that simple thought is an action, and it's creating a energy force. And so we're all like little generators. So if we create that one little thought, and then if somebody else next to us thinks that thought, and another person thinks that thought, it magnifies into our own reality and becomes our reality. So like when there's a lot of anger, you know, like I said, I lived in the Middle East when I was in the 80s. I lived in Israel. So there's like, if you see there's a lot of anger and hatred, and then the next guy hates too, you know, it perpetuates. If you're in South Central LA and you have two gangs, the Bloods and the Crips, I don't know if you're familiar with the gang situation here, but they've shown that, like, even there, I mean, that it's the perpetuating of anger. If you have apathy in thought, you're going to create that apathy. It's like what you think you create, you know. We didn't, you know, it wasn't like Bush became our president because people really, they put that out there, that mentality of that thought, the apathy vote, you know, the security thing, the facade, you know. So we created and allowed that to happen. So in a way, it's very existential. What you think and you create is your own sort of demise in a way.
It
or
is.
A positive output.
One of the things I'm doing at the moment is expanding on the whole kind of Dragons and Rings concept. And I'm looking at kind of creating a book out of it, essentially. And one of the most important bits, and this ties back into the kind of stone circles thing, really, is how we've created the reality that we now live in. It's all totally, totally and absolutely manufactured for a purpose. You can go all conspirational about it, if you like, but essentially it is to maintain a structure of reality, a structure of government. And it all comes back down to the simple fact that at one point we were nomadic, we would walk the land, and it ties into, as you mentioned, with the Native Americans, this concept of ownership. It also ties into, there's a tribe in Africa called the Bushman tribe, who are probably the last vestiges of this kind of nomadic kind of concept, and really only hit the kind of real world, if you like, as we call it, as we see it, this kind of modern world, in the last few decades. And up until then, they were wandering, and, you know, they wouldn't own the land, they wouldn't own each other, it just didn't happen. And that happens when you settle down, when you settle in a place, when you start to build structures, be they stone, be they wood, be they whatever, you then start to own that piece of land. And out of all of that comes everything. If you like, the sins of the Bible, for example, come out of there, because we have the whole kind of coveting thing. We have the whole kind of killing thing. Killing arises is exactly the same thing. It's certainly been archaeologically proved that there weren't any cases of genocide until man settled down and owned a piece of land. And that's amazing, you know. There wouldn't be a need to kill because of that, would there?
And then... It's interesting they said that, because, like, most people, because when they think of religion, they think of just the, you know, the what they're told about religion. But what I also found that pretty fascinating, I wanted to expand upon in your, from your movie, was about when you talk about ancients and how much, like, what you bring about the quantum physics and the relationship of that in your movie with the ancients. And what's really fascinating is, like, I have, you know, I'm a Kabbalist and I've studied Kabbalah, but I'm pretty well known for Taoism as well, and and you can see all the concepts. These are written thousands of years, and if you get into even the Bible, people read it literally. But if you get to the pretext of, you know, what they meant, like God created us in an image, it's because we create our own situations with our own thoughts and expressions. But you can see the same thing, whether it's in the understanding from the Kabbalistic or the Bible or to Taoism, to Sumerian theology, or go to Egyptian theology, they're all saying, or Mayans, they're all saying the same thing. And how would they understand all these concepts and understand it if they didn't know it, like what you, it was expounded upon in your movie, the esoteric, the knowledge that they already received. They may not have built a, you know, a spaceship that goes to the moon, but they are able to facilitate their environment, and in such a way they were able to do unbelievable things. Like, who, you know, so it was that was pretty fascinating how you implemented. But I had one question, because in your movie, it showed that about perception. When we perceive things, that's what we'll see. Because I know about the information that you know, I forgot the percentage. It's so we have a mass amount of information coming to us through all our senses, but then we delineate 90% of it, just so that we can make sense of it. Do you think, and it was sort of like slightly touched on the UFO extraterrestrial thing, what is your view with the relationship to our understanding with extraterrestrials? Because it was made like that we will make up our own reality that they're here, and then maybe that's just a facade, almost like a mirage. But then I believe that we're probably, that it's like the Native Americans when they first saw a ship pulling up with Columbus, that they didn't know what was a ship until their medicine man told them that there was really a ship. Almost the same thing, that there might be an extraterrestrial right in front of you and you wouldn't even know it. Would it be the sort of the same thing?
It's an interesting example, the Columbus one. As far as I understand it, it's an oft-quoted one. Everyone says, oh yeah, Columbus. The quote is that actually no one, it wasn't that they didn't know they were ships. The quote is that these guys kind of didn't even see it, that it didn't exist in their field of vision at all, because they hadn't recognized it. And to be honest with you, it's one of those urban myths. It never happened. But it does serve as a really, really good example. It's a nice example to use, as long as you understand that it's that. That at the end of the day, we do have a perception that is very limited, as I said in the kind of DVD. we receive a huge amount of light rays, for example, and yet we only process from red through to violet because that's all we need. It's useless, if you like, on a survival basis. If you go way back again to the kind of nomadic thing, to the kind of hunter thing, it's useless to have all this information when it doesn't mean anything. So in terms of pure evolution and survival, we tend to wipe out all this information, we disregard it, we put it to one side. Where that leaves me in terms of the extraterrestrial kind of theory, my thoughts are, and I would agree with, there's a lot of research and lots of observation gone on in recent years, that the most of this energy that is being seen, whether it's being seen as craft or whether it's being seen as light sources or whatever, tends to be Earth-related, as in this planet-related, as to, opposed to something that's specifically extraterrestrial from another planet. A lot of the research kind of shows, and this is where I tie it in the whole concept of ley lines and the concepts of stone circles and so forth, that it's more something that's around us, it's an energy that's around us, that's here and now, that's part of the everyday world, rather than something that's kind of specifically magical from some sort of far-flung universe or galaxy out there. And I think one of the things I put in the DVD was Wilhelm Reich and his experiments back in the 20s, where he was kind of perceiving and seeing all this energy and measuring it and seeing what he thought at the time were UFOs, and he got quite kind of upset by it and quite paranoid. But after a bit, he kind of got round to thinking, well, actually, no, it is a kind of form of energy, albeit maybe intelligent in a certain way. It displays intelligence because of the nature of it. But it's very much a kind of Earth-based thing, and I'm very much in favour of that theory because, again, it makes it accessible. It makes it something that we can work with. Once you externalise it, once you put it outside of that reality curve, that bell curve, that circle, if you like, that kind of place, it becomes something that, you know, it's unworkable with. It becomes mythology, it becomes argument, it becomes kind of something that people will just poo-poo because you can never actually prove it, whereas it can be brought into the realms of very much kind of quantum come physical science. Ooh. And therefore, you know, become something that is actually real as opposed to, you know, something that's debatable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but see, what the thing is, I think it's to some extent, I think that's correct, that some what you said, but I think there's a to the other side, there's where people have had actually you know, what they call first contact, or actually visually see, and not just visually out of perception, but they have an interaction, not just because they, you know, but that there is like these other entities or other beings that have had a relationship in the past and now and will be in the future. But I think there's, I personally think there's the concept that there is let's say a rise in opening what's happening with extraterrestrials, because that gets into my own field of theory, is like the changing of the electromagnetic field that's happening within our planet and within our solar system, with expansion of the Earth, which is the real cause of solar, of the global warming effect, which is not just happening on our planet, it's happening throughout our solar system, which is the real truth of what's going on. Humans have some small degree effect on that, but it's really, it's very small. And this electric is affecting our DNA and the changing of energy and et cetera throughout our universe, which is affecting the energy within ourselves and our spirituality. So that's why there's a difference, and that's why I think there's something happening where people's consciousness are rising, changing. It's almost, and then the ETs, for example, because we're pretty a barbaric type of culture, and then all of a sudden you come in and you see these people, you know, if you're an extraterrestrial and you're quite advanced and you see, you know, what we are, come on, fighting over land, they laugh at you, you know, or fighting over who has a better car. But, you know, it would, it's So there's like, I see the duality, because I saw what you had in there, but I see there is, I think there's a link, and I think, like your knowledge and everybody else's knowledge is like, so I look at the, also in the substance of, I don't know if you've ever heard this, because is the antimatter-matter theory understanding is, you know, when you go faster, on this, the perception that we see on this side of the plane is three-dimensional it's a space and one-dimensional time. And on the flip is called the antimatter, which when you go faster the speed of light, and you flip over, called the reverse donut, and you all of a sudden get into seeing that is where you have three-dimensional time and one-dimensional space, which is... And that's where people go, like the astral projection area, where you go, that's where the other side, and that's where actually the phenomenon of how you go through, you know, how can extraterrestrials fly into this realm, if you want to call it, it's almost like that's the creation of the so-called, like, Stargate. They can break through the timeline, because they don't look at linear. You know, it's like you had brought up, like, the words and the concepts that we use. It's so funny, because I was thinking, when I saw your show, the funniest thing, because I was thinking, wow, I wasn't sure you're in Australia or England, but there's a line, like, I forget where it is exactly on the world, where that if you just step over, it's like the following day. You know, I think it's Jordan or Japan. But then, wait a second, isn't that the same where, so we've really drawn our area and made up, we've basically made up what time is, and that's not really the reality. You know, no. Like I'm talking to you, and what time is in the UK, but then I'm over here, like right now it's like 11:30 or so, Pacific time, which we created. Now, if I go further, like over, there's like the border for us, if I just go over, not even an hour's drive into Arizona, I'm in another time zone, you know? And so if I live right on that border and I walked over it, I'd be in a different hour.
Isn't that strange?
And then but that's not reality.
No, to me there is a key to it, an almost simple key, but it's not simple. It flips your mind because it says that everything that you say is absolutely right, and it also says that everything you say is absolutely wrong. The key to it, if you imagine a circle with a dot in the middle, it's been kind of handed down through thousands of years, through secret societies, you name it. It's kind of the ultimate glyph. It's the sun glyph. It's everything, the universal glyph. And what it really says is, in two ways, first of all, that the universe is absolutely infinite. It is, if you like, you're the dot in the center of the circle, and absolutely everything around the edge can exist, because it is simply what you kind of put there. It does say that from a kind of dimensional perspective, you could suggest quite easily, you know, I could quite easily say, well, dimensionally, the distance between, for example, us and the furthest galaxy seems absolutely immense, but that is only working again in, as you say, the kind of three or four dimensions, including time, assuming they're all linear. But once you turn them into a circle, it's literally the flip side of the circle that you're looking at, which is as near as you are. And that kind of gets people kind of, it's very hard to explain and very hard to get the hang of. So you almost have to say, well, yeah, you're absolutely right. ETs can exist because the space isn't as infinite as we think. It is only infinite because we've created this reality that allows it to be, because we're limiting ourselves in the way that we perceive it. And that then comes into the second kind of thing, is that reality is what we perceive. We are creating that circle from the center. We are, if you like, in the kind of Descartes or Buddha kind of sense, we see, we think, we therefore we are. And effectively, reality is what's going on in the center of our head, in the center of our brain, and therefore how we affect it, how we create it, becomes what it is. And that, to me, is very kind of positive, because what it does is it acknowledges that we all have, if you like, not the right, that isn't the kind of the right word, but we certainly have the right to believe and see what we see, because that is our own reality. And therefore, it is in a way justifiable. What's unjustifiable is when you say that reality is absolutely correct. If I were to say that everything that I'm now saying and have said is absolutely correct, then that would make me infallible, and that is entirely wrong. You know, it is my perception, if you like, that I'm presenting now, and I've presented on the DVD, but it's that kind of thing that we can kind of twist things around and say, okay, that exists there because, we can certainly say that energy exists and therefore matter exists. And because matter is based on energy, then if we put a thought into that energy, then those beings are there. Are they a reflection of ourselves in the Descartes sense, or are they external? Are they something that is out there? And that's the everlasting question. And the real answer is that, in fact, they are actually both, because of that kind of flip side, that donut kind of thing of reality that you can kind of flip it in on its head. And in one respect, you look at it in one way, and in another respect, you look at it in another way.
Well, that's like the quantum look at is energy particle or is it wave or both?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then what the hell is a wave?
and the really funny thing in the quantum sense is that in effect it is always a wave. It's a potential wave. It's a chance wave, if you like. It's the potential of something happening. And until you observe it, until you interact with it, it is always the full potential of what it's going to be. And what a lot of people forget, and this is kind of really important, again, that a lot of kind of new agey kind of stuff has jumped on the back of that and said, we can create absolutely anything. Whoa, we can make our reality what it is what you said earlier on, that we are interconnected. And this is where the kind of string theory of quantum comes in, that everything links to everything. So you can't simply create, because you create on the back end of everyone else creating. So it becomes a co-creative, coexistence process. Once you understand that, then that again allows you to kind of break that bubble a little bit and to work that bubble in a far more kind of progressive way than simply saying, well, I'll make it happen. Why hasn't it happened? Oops.
So basically, it's like what you brought in, which I thought, now this is the most fascinating thing I thought in your movie. I watched, it would probably piss off a lot of scientists, is how...
Yeah.
The area where they either subconsciously or whatever in their own thought process had an idea of the outcome of an experiment, creating their experiment, they reached, you know, it's like the ends justify the means, but they really created their own means to get to the ends that they really wanted to get to in the first place. So, you know, and I thought that was very funny because, you know, I've seen a lot of different scientists, and they tend to get, you know, I'm not saying there's a lot of ego in there, but there's definitely a lot of ego involvement into their subject, because it's like their reflection of them, I guess, for their thesis or whatever they're trying to accomplish, so they will not necessarily, I would say, consciously try to manipulate things. But just the thought process of projecting out that energy, they may include, like what you put, possibly change the outcome of the experiment, which I thought was really funny. I mean, of all things.
It's certainly what kind of tipped, if you like, the whole kind of quantum theory. That was the kind of thing that kind of made it spring into, like, oh, gosh, what's going on here? We have to kind of reinvest. Negate our ideas. I think the other thing is as well, it's the bugbear of any science. The second you start experimenting, you are actually creating an artificial set of circumstances. For example, if you put something under a microscope, in order to see it under a microscope, you have to prepare it in some way, i.e. you have to slice it up, you have to squash it, you have to put some kind of color or dye in, and straight away you've changed what you're actually looking at, and you're never therefore actually in reality seeing what's going on. And because you've sliced it up as well, you've taken a little part of it. You aren't seeing it in the whole. You aren't seeing it both in terms of respect to the rest of it in a single space or in terms of time either. You're only seeing that briefest of snapshots and then trying to kind of put them all back together into this kind of linear kind of way to say, well, this is how time and matter and everything works.
So let me ask you this, because this is also, because I know it's also in your bio. How do you incorporate your quantum aspects or physics into your metaphysics?
It comes down to understanding what quantum's about, understanding the kind of scientific aspect, and we've almost kind of said it in everything that we've said. The fact that essentially we can say scientifically, we can say that the world that we live in, the reality, the solidity of the world that we live in is based upon a wave structure, and that wave structure is A, based on probability, and B, based upon the way we as a group of people work into it, integrate into it, see it, perceive it, and change it. So therefore, that allows us on a metaphysical level far much control, a self-control, if you like, to be able to say, well, oh, we are actually responsible for what's gone on. We are responsible, or part responsible, for the things around us. Once we agree that we're part responsible for it, if not entirely responsible, that shows, you know, how, if you like, in control we really, really are, and shows, you know, how maybe apathetic, as you kind of put it earlier on, we have been. And, you know, it then presents, do we want to maintain the apathy, or do we want to maybe change reality? Do we want to impact in it? And because we as individuals are part of the whole, we can have that impact. We can have that state of change. We can make things happen around us on a global level, simply, as you said, by the non-locality thing earlier on. We have an idea. I have an idea. I'll put it in a book. It arrives on your desk. Now we're talking on radio, and lots of people are listening to it. Gosh, the impact of that is amazing. If you think about it, it's huge.
Well, I think...
Just sitting at my desk on the computer, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, you know, it would definitely, you know, people realized, you know, it's like people who, I think there's like, and this in a different sense, like I believe, you know, and this I said in a past show that I did regarding past lives, but I believe that we pick our lives, our soul speak, or pick our, and then it's like a coloring chart we fill in.
Mm.
But, and we have choices, and it's constantly we're making choices, and why the choice, we are, and even though we've had something pre, some of it's pre-karma, some of it's our own choosing, because there's a to me there's a quasi-duality in that, that thing that you meet into, with your reaction, that can be just a thought, your emotion is your thought. And some of you have asked me, and I brought up, is, you know, what is, you know, manifesting? You heard people creating things. So mm-hmm. You always use the old thing called web, and it's like will, motion, belief. And if you believe, it's out of that one thought. If you put out a thought and you will it, and then you have a motion is like the velocity of it, and then you will it is like the initial push of it, the initial inertia of the thought. And belief is the carry on, how much more fuel behind the thought, right? So it's like the faith of that thought. So then all that put together creates that little bundle of energy that you've thrown out there, and that can be on the slightest elm, and that will reflect, bounce onto you. So you can constantly create, like, you know, when somebody says, oh, God, you know, this is so rough, I don't know what I'm going to do, you just put that out. I don't know what I'm going to do, and that's what you're going to get. Or...
Yep.
You know, and then there's some things that, you know, people ask me, well, what am I full of? I'm living in a, right now, a destitute. I don't have that much money. I'm barely making it. That I can't barely put a roof over my head, let alone for my kids. And I think there's a dual process in that. Part of it, I think, is manifest in them, but partially it's when you come in this embodiment and you know, when your consciousness is out of this body, your soul never dies. It's always there, and it's created the reality when you've come in that you're about to experience. And your reaction to that experience is your lesson for your consciousness and that your spirit, and that's how it evolves. So when you get into the quantum physics of it and it merges together and people look at it, to me, it makes more, even more sense and more understanding. It's actually... what I like, what you brought out, you've made it. People write millions of books and have millions, you know, and they do shows and they do all kinds of stuff, and they make things more complicated than it really is. And what I liked about your movie, it made it really simple, exactly really what it is, and simple to the function that everything's more quasi, and people, oh, that's really complex. It really isn't. It's like, what's his name, the writer for Tao Te Ching, they used to say that you don't know, and in Kabbalah, you don't know something, you actually have an understanding of something. And like in Hebrew, You know, the word, you heard people when they finish a prayer, they go, amen?
Yes.
Okay, the literal meaning in Hebrew, when they say amen or emet, there's no word really means truth. There's no such word in Hebrew that means truth. It's actually what you believe.
Mm.
So it's your perception of what the truth is.
It comes back from the Egyptian kind of sense. It was adopted from the Egyptian word amen, but it also ties into the whole kind of Greek kind of concept of the new and the kind of concept of the nous and stuff ties into the kind of the Indian kind of concept of Brahma and Maya in terms of reality and truth and kind of illusion and all kind of stuff like that, doesn't it?
But I was trying to get back to, it goes back to what you said in the very beginning of the show, it's on your language.
Yeah.
So it's like that particular culture, like also in Arabic, they have the same word, amen. Their emet is amen. So they have the same relationship, what is truth is what they believe is in truth. Mm. And then in English, it's truth is like an absolute thing.
Yeah.
So everybody has their own concept, and like it's their own language, like what you had said in the beginning of the show, which I think is really funny. It's like, our reality is what we think we say it is, our communication, our language, and what we identify. It's funny.
I could sit here and kind of argue at you for ages about either past lives or karma, all kinds of things. And the reason I kind of don't, in a way, is because it's linguistic. We're arguing about a word, an absolute meaning of words, when in reality what it is that we haven't quite understood a concept. We have the same concept, but we explain it in words that then have this inherent meaning. To me, karma, for example, people use karma as a way to say, well, it's happened, so I can't do anything about it. Whereas to me, karma is about that ability to take choice on board and make it your own karma. You know, karma becomes something that you can initiate.
Right, your reaction to it.
I'm going to give you an example, a different example, because I think this is absolutely, you know, this is something I've encountered in the physical and, you know, adjusted to. I've worked for a long, long time, in fact, since I was a kid, because of who I grew up with and stuff like that. I won't go into it. But anyway, people with learning disabilities. And I worked in social services for quite a while and in education and so forth. And one of the phrases that is constantly used is that this person displays challenging behavior. This person is challenging. And people try to kind of adjust that challenging behavior. And what people aren't realizing is that the behavior is challenging because it challenges them. Does that make sense?
They say
that person is being challenging, so we're going to change that person. But in reality, what they're really saying is, I am challenged. Once you accept that you are the person who's being challenged, you can deal with that behavior by dealing with how it challenges you. And therefore, once you've accepted that you are being challenged and that you can say, actually, no, I don't need to be challenged by that because I can see it from a different light, all of a sudden that person doesn't have challenging behavior anymore, not because you've adjusted them, but because you've reacted and changed the way that you perceive. And, you know, like I say, I've done this on the ground, practically. I've worked with people on kind of changing their thought patterns on this and change situations and change kind of people's lives, if you like, literally by just saying, well, whoa, you know, bring it home. Think about the way you're reacting. Think about how you can change, literally, your own karma, if you like, your own challenge, and simply say, well, it doesn't have to be challenging because that's just the way I'm looking at it. If I look at it as, hey, that behavior is quite exciting, that behavior is quite interesting, that behavior is quite chaotic, whoa, wow, you know, all of a sudden the doors are open to say, let's work with these people, let's really kind of make something interesting happen, as opposed to simply trying to stop stuff happening.
Steve, before I close, because we're getting closer to my show.
Hello.
I know, time just flew by. I want everybody to know how they can get your a DVD of your movie or the website and any additional information. So please tell all right now.
Well, there's a number of sources you need to go to. Most of it's internet-based because that's the way kind of things go at the moment, although we're getting things out, hopefully, into bookshops and so forth. There's a website literally called www.dragonsandrings.com, all one word, which you can go on to. I'm putting articles up on there. You can kind of read a little bit more in depth about some of the stuff on the video. You can buy the video from there through Reel to Can, which is one of our companies. In America, Reality Entertainment, again, www.reality-entertainment.com, sell the video, and, sorry, DVD nowadays, isn't it? You can buy it on Amazon.com, you can buy it on BarnesandNoble.com, literally just type in Dragons and Rings and it'll come up on there and pop your money in and it arrives in your house.
Well, one thing good, I'm going to have it on my posting in the archive, but if anybody misses it, you know, they can feel free in contacting me for that information again.
That's great.
Is there any direct information if anyone wants to contact you, questions about your movie?
Yeah,
or
again, go to the Dragons and Rings site and email me from there. Steve@dragonsandrings.com will also get to me. You can also find out, as I'm kind of working on the book concept and where I'm going to take that. I want that to be a bit more interactive with kind of little kind of things, if you like, for people to do, as well as a little expansion on the kind of scientific side. So if people really want to get into the real science, they can kind of pick it up there. And at the same time, they can try out things at home, you know, try out little experiments and dowsing, for example, learn how to douse and things like that. So dragonsandrings.com is probably the best source for either getting to me, getting to the DVD, and finding out things as they use as it occurs.
Well, Steve, I want to thank you for coming on my show. This is definitely a fascinating subject for me, and I know my fellow listeners, because everybody wants to know about that stuff. Again, that was Steve Mitchell, and like you said, you can contact him at www.dragonsandrings.com. And he has his contact information there, and as well as purchasing his DVD. I highly recommend it. It's fascinating. It's not a movie that you watch once or twice. It's something that you definitely go back and forth to, you know, learn more concepts, and it you can incorporate into your life and your spirituality, whether it's into the sciences or just your metaphysics. Again, I want to thank you, Steve, for coming on my show. It's great having you here. And to all of you out there, I wish you God bless, and hope you enjoy a little bit more of Omni, No Racial Barriers. Thank you, and God bless you all.
Thank you for having me.